Welcome to Analyzing Trends. Today, we're talking about shibboleths, you know, the kind of words or phrases that instantly tell you who's in, who's out, and what side of the fence you're standing on. The word itself comes from the Hebrew Bible. It was used as a linguistic test. People who pronounced it one way were considered part of the group. If you got it wrong, you were seen as outsiders. In that context, it was a matter of life and death. Fast forward to today and the stakes are different, but the mechanism is still at play. We still use language along with style, tone, and references to mark cultural belonging. Shibboleths aren't just slang or neat phrases, they're signals. They tell you what someone identifies with, what they value, and which cultural circles they move in. If you're tuned in, you can spot them in everything from sneaker drops to startup pitches to how someone describes their morning routine. And in branding, that kind of signaling is critical. Get it right and you resonate. Get it wrong and you lose trust fast. So in this episode, we're going to unpack why shibboleths matter right now. We'll look at how they shape identity, how brands and institutions try to use them, and what happens when they fall flat. Let's take a closer look. So, why does language matter so much for brands? In a world overloaded with data, algorithms, and constant noise, language remains one of the clearest and most powerful tools we have. It's not just about what people say, it's about how they say it. The tone, the rhythm, the choice of words, all of it signals something deeper. Language carries subtext. It reveals values, intentions, and affiliations, often without the speaker even realizing it. The brands that understand this tend to do better. They read between the lines. They pay attention to cultural nuance. They speak in a way that feels native to the spaces they're in. The brands that don't, they start to sound off, like they've missed the reference, like they showed up to the wrong place and didn't realize it until everyone else turned to look. In branding, that kind of dissonance matters. Because when language doesn't align with culture, people notice. And when people notice, they disengage. Think about hashtags, slogans, even protest signs that circulate on social media. These are all condensed forms of language, but they carry a lot of cultural weight. Take the phrase pasture raised. Not long ago, that was a straightforward description. Cows in a field, nothing more. But today, it means something else. It's not just about agriculture. It's about ideology, ethical sourcing, anti-industrial sentiment, a desire for authenticity in a system that often feels artificial. That shift turns pasture raised into a shibboleth. If you understand the context, the phrase signals alignment with a broader worldview. You recognize what it's really saying beyond the literal. And if you don't, then it might still just sound like cows in a field. You miss the deeper meaning, and with it, the cultural connection. And that's the shift from descriptive to symbolic. Words aren't just functional anymore. They're carrying meaning. They're carrying values. They're carrying identity. What used to be neutral language now comes with cultural weight. And brands, whether they intend to or not, are positioned right in the middle of that shift. Every word they choose signals something. Sometimes it's intentional, sometimes it's not. But either way, people are listening. Now let's zoom out a bit. How do we actually make sense of all these shifting meanings? How do we know when a word or idea is gaining cultural momentum or beginning to lose its relevance? That's where culture mapping comes in. It's a framework we developed at Scenario through years of ethnographic research and client work, combining natural language processing and machine learning with applied semiotics. This model builds on Raymond Williams' method of cultural analysis and organizes language and ideas into four quadrants: residual, dominant, emergent, and disruptive. Residual refers to ideas that are still around but fading in relevance. Dominant reflects what's widely accepted right now. Emergent captures ideas that are just starting to take hold. And disruptive refers to concepts that challenge mainstream thinking and force cultural reevaluation. Take smart technology. Not long ago, that phrase landed in the emergent or even disruptive space. It suggested innovation, efficiency, and a more connected future. Smart homes, smart cars, smart assistants, it all carried a sense of progress. Today, the term is largely dominant. It's embedded in daily life. From thermostats to refrigerators to wearable devices, smart tech is marketed as the norm. But here's where the tension comes in. As the idea became dominant, so did concerns. People started asking what they were trading for that convenience. Surveillance, data harvesting, loss of privacy. Those issues are becoming harder to ignore. In response, new language is emerging. Terms like privacy-first design or ethical tech are gaining ground. They sit in the emergent space now, but they're rising quickly as cultural values shift. Culture mapping helps us track those shifts. It shows how a concept like smart technology doesn't sit still. It moves, it morphs, and it invites tension. And that tension is where the most important cultural questions get asked. Now, to really understand how culture mapping works, it helps to see it visually. Picture a grid split into four quadrants. At first glance, it looks like a simple X and Y axis, but what it actually shows is how stories move through culture over time. It's structured like a three-act play because culture doesn't just shift, it evolves through narrative. Let's start with the quadrants. The upper left is the residual story space. This is where cultural patterns and values are held over from the past. They're familiar. They carry legacy power. Think of ideas shaped by tradition, hierarchy, or inherited authority. Archetypes like the everyman, the ruler, and the caregiver live here. They help establish rules and standards. The upper right is the dominant story space. This is where mainstream culture lives. These are the values and symbols that have been widely accepted, often without question. Language in this space is stable, recognizable, and deeply tied to collective identity. It's also where cohesion is built through archetypes like the innocent, the lover, and the hero. The bottom right is the emergent story space. This is where experimentation happens. It's where new materials, formats, and languages are tested. Nothing's quite stable here yet, but there's energy. The explorer, creator, and jester are the archetypes moving this space forward. They reflect a culture in the middle of trying something new. The bottom left is the disruptive story space. This is where radical ideas surface. It's not about tweaking the dominant, it's about challenging it entirely. Here you'll find the rebel, the sage, and the magician, forces that imagine new systems and push boundaries. Now tie that to the movement through the acts. Act 1 is a call to action. Something isn't working in the residual and dominant order. That tension creates pressure. Disruptive and residual forces start to clash, setting the stage for change. Act 2 is the renewal. Language gets redefined. Emergent patterns gain momentum. Experiments become more coherent. It's where alternatives are tested, refined, and slowly begin to surface. Act 3 is a new order. What was once emergent becomes dominant. It's established through social currency, codified. At this stage, cohesion returns, but with a different shape. Let's go back to our example of smart technology. Early on, it emerged from the disruptive space. It was fueled by magician logic, technology as transformation. It challenged analog systems and introduced a vision of seamless automation. Over time, it became dominant. Smart speakers, smart lights, smart homes. All of it framed as convenience, as progress. It spoke the language of the hero and the lover, saving time, simplifying life, anticipating your needs. But now we're seeing disruption rise again. Surveillance, data ownership, algorithmic bias, these aren't fringe concerns anymore. They've become cultural flashpoints, terms like decentralized, privacy first, and algorithmic transparency are moving in from the emergent space. and archetypes like the rebel and sage are re-entering the conversation, challenging the assumptions that made smart tech dominant in the first place. Culture mapping helps make this visible, not just as trend lines, but as narratives, shifting languages, clashing values, and the story systems that help us make sense of change. And for brands, that's not just interesting, it's essential. To make this more concrete, I want to share some work from a workshop I led with students this week at Parsons School of Design. In the session, we used culture mapping and the concept of shibboleths to analyze how brands embed meaning into their products and experiences. But more than that, we asked the students to take the theory and build from it, to decode the cultural codes behind a brand, then use that understanding to prototype new touchpoints that act as shibboleths, signals that quietly separate those who get it from those who don't. Let's walk through a few examples. Start with Ray-Ban. The students identified Ray-Ban's key cultural codes as heritage, emotion, craft, and provenance. In other words, it's not just about style, it's about lineage. So they created a touchpoint concept called the Maker's Mark, a small, engraved signature, only visible upon close inspection. It functions as a shibboleth. It's not performative, it's not loud, but if you notice it, you're in. You understand that this isn't just a pair of sunglasses, it's a crafted artifact. That tiny detail carries the weight of insider fluency, a quiet nod to provenance and emotional value. Now look at IKEA. IKEA's codes were identified as fluid identity, adaptability, and mobility. The students saw the brand sitting between the emergent and dominant quadrants on the culture map. So they created the concept of a nomad pod, a compact modular furniture kit designed to support a mobile, minimalist lifestyle. Again, this isn't just furniture, it's a shibboleth. It communicates that you live with intention, that you're fluent in movement, micro-rituals, and hybrid domesticity. Muji offered a different challenge, its cultural codes centered around transparency, ritual use, and minimal identity, placing it between the residual and emergent quadrants. Here, the students introduced the commons space concept, open, modular environments designed without hierarchy. Knowing how to use the Muji commons becomes the shibboleth. It's not labeled, it's not explained. But if you understand the spatial cues and the behavior it invites, you're in. That fluency is a form of social literacy, an alignment with quiet care and community-first design. With Samsung, the team leaned into disruption. Their cultural codes were attunement, consent, and sensory clarity, signaling a shift in how tech positions itself. The concept? Minimal mode. A mode that silences the interface, not to shut down, but to reconnect with intention. It's a shibboleth that redefines what control looks like. It's not about more features. It's about restraint. And that restraint signals something subversive in a world of hyper-optimization. Finally, Duolingo. Students mapped the brand between the dominant and emergent quadrants, working with codes like humor, fluency, and playful status. They came up with the Duo Passport, a stamp system that doesn't just show what you've learned, but how you've learned. The shibboleth here is emotional. It's about signaling effort and immersion, not test scores. Fluency becomes a felt experience, not a graded one. Together, these examples show how culture mapping and shibboleths don't just help us interpret culture, they help us build with it. They allow us to ask better questions. What codes are rising, which are fading? What does a brand actually mean to the people who interact with it? And how can we design for those meanings in ways that feel true, not manufactured? What these students did and what this framework supports isn't just strategic insight, it's cultural fluency. And in a world where meaning is always shifting, that fluency is what separates signal from noise. Now let's talk about what's powering this process behind the scenes: computational linguistics and machine learning. That might sound technical, but here's the basic idea. These are tools that help us study language the way you'd study data. With computational linguistics, we can break down language into measurable units. We can look at how often a word shows up, what kinds of words it appears next to, and how its meaning shifts depending on the context or community. It's like creating a cultural map, not based on opinion, but based on patterns in the language itself. Machine learning takes that even further. It scans massive volumes of conversation, social media, articles, transcripts, any place where culture is being spoken, and starts to identify trends we might miss on our own. And here's where it gets really interesting. When you assign numerical values to words, not just frequency, but sentiment, proximity, movement across communities, you start to see how meaning behaves like a living system. You can detect when a word like sustainability is losing specificity, or when something like quiet luxury suddenly spikes in one subculture and starts bleeding into others. This isn't just about tracking hashtags, it's about revealing the underlying shifts in values, worldviews, and identity. Language becomes a signal system. And when we visualize those shifts using culture mapping, we can start to see which codes are rising, which are fading, and what that means in social terms. Why does this matter for brands? Because if you're only looking at surface-level buzz, you're reacting after the fact. But if you can read the deeper pattern, if you know when a term is moving from emergent to dominant, you can move with culture in real time. You can spot when a shibboleth is gaining power, or when it's becoming hollow. That's the difference between chasing relevance and actually embodying it. When brands understand language as data, they don't just see what people are saying, they understand what people mean, and that's where real strategy begins. Let's get more specific about how this works. When we talk about tracking language and cultural meaning, we're using tools like natural language processing, or NLP. It's a set of techniques that helps computers break down and analyze human language, not just words, but structure, tone, and intent. With NLP, we can measure things like syntax, sentiment, and metaphor, basically how people are talking and what emotional weight their words carry. It gives us a way to look at large volumes of language and find patterns that aren't immediately obvious. From there, we look at semantic drift. That just means we track how the meaning of a word shifts over time. For example, a word like freedom might mean one thing in a legal or political context, but take on a completely different meaning in advertising or activism. These shifts aren't random, they follow cultural patterns. And by measuring how those patterns move, we can see where language and the values behind it are going. Pattern detection helps us surface recurring themes. It shows us which words and phrases tend to cluster together in different communities. That's how we identify new shibboleths, those specific words or references that signal belonging before they become mainstream. We also use Bayesian modeling, which is a method for updating our understanding as new information comes in. It helps us stay responsive. Instead of treating language as fixed, it allows us to adjust based on how meaning is shifting in real time. This all connects back to the idea that language is not static. Shibboleths don't just stay in one place, they move across platforms, across cultures, and across generations. By using these tools to measure and track that movement, we can understand how meaning spreads, how it mutates, and how it signals deeper cultural change. That's why this matters for brands. It's not enough to look at what people are saying. You need to understand what those words mean in context and how that meaning is changing. That's how you stay aligned with culture instead of falling behind it. So, how do brands avoid misreading these signals? The truth is, it's not easy. It takes more than just tracking what's trending. You have to listen closely, you have to stay adaptable, and at times, you have to acknowledge that you might not be the cultural expert in the room. That humility matters, because the risks of getting it wrong are real. When a brand uses language that's out of step or worse, misaligned with the values of the audience, it doesn't just sound awkward, it signals that you're not paying attention. And in a cultural landscape that moves fast, that kind of disconnection can cost you relevance overnight. Now, can brands actually lead cultural change, or are they mostly just reacting to it? It's a fair question. A lot of the time, it can feel like brands are simply trying to catch up, responding to whatever's already gaining traction. But the ones that truly pay attention, those that tune into shibboleths and take the time to map meaning rather than just measure sentiment, can do more than respond. They can influence the direction of the conversation. That said, it's not about taking the lead for its own sake, it's about timing. Cultural leadership isn't a fixed role, it's conditional. Sometimes you set the tone, sometimes you amplify what's already happening. The key is knowing the difference and having the awareness to act with precision, not just presence. So, where does that leave us? Cultural fluency isn't optional anymore. It's not a bonus or a branding edge. It's the baseline. If a brand wants to stay relevant, it has to understand the language of culture, not just the language of marketing. That means paying attention to how words evolve. It means knowing what signals belonging, what feels outdated, and what's just starting to take hold. It's not about chasing trends. It's about reading the deeper shifts in meaning and responding with clarity and intention. And here's the point. Listening is a form of leadership. It's not about having all the answers. It's about paying close attention to how meaning shifts and being ready to adjust when it does. In past episodes, we've looked at how this plays out in different ways, whether it's the emotional tone of a brand, the mechanics of scapegoating, or the changing social rules around things like ghosting. In every case, meaning was moving. The brands that succeed aren't the ones that react the fastest. They're the ones that listen differently. They read shibboleths as signals, clues about identity, values, and context, not just as clever phrases or surface-level branding. All right, that's it for this episode of Analyzing Trends. If you're interested in how shifts in language and meaning shape other parts of culture, stay with us. We'll keep tracing the signals. But here's the thought to leave with. Shibboleths aren't just cultural passwords. They're markers of where we are and where we're going. They reveal what we value, what we protect, and what we're starting to question. So if you want to understand the future, start by listening for the words that divide, unite, or quietly let someone in. Because the language we choose isn't just expression, it's direction. Thank you for listening in.